Okay. So could you introduce yourself?
Yes, hello, I'm Johnny Heron, and I became involved in this project through my appointment at the Capital Centre as their research associate, specifically to think about Shakespeare and performance archives within teaching and learning. But then another value emerged, which was my background as a theatre director. So I was brought in for a range of emergent projects with different departments across the university to start delivering events and experiences that required kind of theatre experience or drama education work, and that became the foundational content for the Open Space Learning project.
Okay, thanks. You mentioned, I suppose, particularly drama in education work, and I'm wondering what, if any, you see any difference between drama education and OSL, or do you, can you talk a little bit about that distinction?
I think in terms of terminology, I would suggest that there is a difference between the curricular imperative of drama education, which is always fundamentally either learning about drama or through drama. And although claims have been made for the discipline beyond that, that is the focus. And that's first of all how drama education differentiates itself from, say, actor training or theatre education, which will not foreground the learning through. It'll be more about learning about skills and vocational and aesthetic preparation for the field or the craft. Now, that part of drama education that traditionally, certainly Jonathan Nealance has been very involved with, but might go back to a genealogy that would involve Dorothy Heathcote, Gavin Bolton, but also connect to sort of radical pedagogies, Freire's and his influence on Augusto Boal, Theatre of the Oppressed. All of that stuff's very keyed into drama education, but there is still fundamentally a dramatic process taking place. Now, with open space learning, the terminology allows also not only the method and the content, but also the aesthetic experience to be literally open. So part of decentralizing the drama education and focusing on an openness, but also learning, not education, allows the focus to be reorientated around whatever the context is, be that dictated by student or educator. So in that sense, it genuinely is more open. It does rely on certain systems which could be perceived as closed, like structure, planning, disciplinarity, economics, but its hope is for an open space beyond a discipline, and drama education suggests disciplinarity.
In that context, have you found open space learning to be a challenge for you personally, considering your background in drama
Yeah,
education?
I have actually, because I would say that I'm probably a third generation drama educator, and previous generations of drama educators have either claimed to teach solely through drama, and then a counterculture which might be represented by people like David Hornbrooke, who have said, well, no, what are we learning about drama? We've got to teach them the art form of drama and theatre studies. The classic example he gives in education and dramatic art is that who are we to let children, for example, because he's talking about drama in schools, do this sort of EastEnders style acting about whatever they want to do, whatever they want to explore, and then we go and see Hamlet at the weekend? What is the kind of cultural, what are the issues of cultural inclusion around that? There comes a point where the educator is responsible for introducing something of the craft or the intellectual potential of a subject. So that's always been a very contentious area in drama education, and Jonathan has quite a declared position in relation to that. I was trained in a tradition that was more synthetic, in that it tried to combine the previous two generations' problems, in that I genuinely believe that these methods could be used to teach about and through, not one or the other. But this is why, for example, in schools, drama is not on, not a national curricular subject. And it's why the field, even in higher education, still has huge disputes about terminology. For example, a lot of drama departments have become theatre and performance departments, and you'll be aware of the difference between a self-proclaiming theatre studies department from a performance studies department. So this has really meant that, ironically, the field is always contentious, and I've found the biggest challenge to me as quite a self-proclaimed drama and theatre educator who is interested in the craft and the aesthetics and not eroding the knowledges of the theatre artist. And I have a very particular background that is connected to the classical theatre and to Shakespeare and to Beckett. And although I am interested in improvisatory methods and devising a new work, I had come from that background. And when I was a drama teacher in schools, I was very clear that I was teaching them about drama. Yes, we can learn about any human experience through this, but that for me was a challenge. And actually in this project I've been forced to think at tertiary level about why it's important to consider both. So that's been a challenge for me, but I would say I've come out the other end and I've sort of learned maths and drama is a good example of this, where rather than me imposing my disciplinary interest on the group, which would have been Beckett and Laban, it was much more interesting for me and ultimately more powerful for them to just facilitate the mathematicians who wanted to stand up and try out a bit of drama and embody a bit of maths in an embodied way.
Yeah.
And that's when I suddenly thought, ah, right, this is what we're doing.
Yeah.
So yes, it had that come from a challenge.
Yeah.
But it ends up with a real endorsement of the method.
And perhaps one way that you've negotiated this is through the ensemble. As well, and maybe you could talk a little bit about what work you do with the ensemble, because there is a technical, and aesthetic expertise there, as well as the open space learning applications.
That's right, and I would suggest that the openness of the work is measurable against what the skills base is of those people who can enable that open work. So you have to have strong workshop facilitation. And you have to have, where necessary, strong examples of performance. And you've seen the ensemble used in that way. Because that's sort of like, in literary studies, the set text. It's the stimulus for the learning experience. So it's very important to me that OSL has this training of the student ensemble as a central strand. Because that, for me personally, provides an engine room for ideas. You know, I have to be connected with big questions about theatre and performance, otherwise I wouldn't be able to apply those to other disciplines. So I'm quite passionate about the idea that we don't ignore where this has come from. And for me, the ensemble space, which is a physical space and a space for training young actors or new kinds of theatre practitioners, potentially future educators, is an engine room. And it's a central strand, and if it wasn't there, I don't think we could make the claims that we're making, because I don't think our encounters with students have enough, they're not longitudinal in the way that my work with the ensemble is. You know, I'm developing some of them over many years.
And will they, do you think many of them will go into education in particular?
I think their primary interest in it is theatre. And I know that some of them want to become actors, but a bit like the work that Jonathan's done with the RSC actors on the PG Cert, we're creating different kinds of artists. We're creating teaching artists. And we're putting at the heart of a artist vocational experience an educational imperative other than their own. But vice versa, it may be that some of them reroute into education, drama teaching or training, because they've had this experience.
They're
like, oh, you know, there are other things than just acting. There are other uses for the performer.
Could you give us some examples, just one or two from the last couple of years?
Well, let's first of all, students have already left. Who started working with me before the Open Space Learning Project, as part of Capital in the Lorca production and then came back in, a lot of them only realise the effect of the training upon departure or as they're going into other things. So it's only recently that I start to get those sort of emails and that kind of response. We had a student in this room 2 days ago who's applying to drama school because she's actually gone out and done quite a lot of arts admin work since graduating from Warwick. She'd found a space to perform with me but in the student drama work, she wasn't able to perform because there's perceived to be a sort of star system within the student body, and she ended up as a producer because she was a good organiser. In her degree, which is Theatre and Performance Studies, certain kinds of performance are privileged over traditional acting approaches. So she's gone out there, she's done the arts admin role because that's the role she'd fallen into amongst student drama, but she's thought back to the work she did with me and she's decided to train as an actress because she feels it's in identifying as an actress and being a performer in the world, as it were, that she might actually begin to understand her professional and personal self. Another student who's at RADA at the moment training as a director there, doing the MA that I did, which used to be with King's College, it's now with Birkbeck, has formed an ensemble at RADA out of his MA people and people who are interested because he's been in that model. He trained with me here. He was a theatre and performance student who did the Beckett laboratory stuff with me and then also actually applied for and successfully got a production placement in a show that we did professionally at the Oxford Playhouse. So he got that kind of really targeted real world approach as well. And he's seen the value of this. So now the way in which he is developing a professional life for himself is sort of based on this model he's been part of himself. And so there's already a group that's established in London based on that. And then the current students, when starting to articulate what this space is, talk about it as a space between things. So they frequently say, it's different from my degree because, some of them say, it is more valuable than my degree because, and they say, but it's also different from stuff I do in the union with other students because. And they identify this sort of third space, if you like, as a space that is professionalized, but still open to taking risks and being able to learn through failure and trial and error. But they also talk about, and I don't know how it compares, they talk about the sort of depth of experience that they have on our projects because they're taken seriously as adults, which rather suggests that on their actual courses they're not, or perhaps they don't have access, as in their tutors don't spend the same amount of time with them. Like, you know, I can't spend time with loads and loads and loads of students, but when I'm working with that ensemble group, we have a long process, which means that fundamentally the tutorial relationship is different.
But do you think that this, to bring it back to the more sporadic OSL events and the less immersive OSL events that we do through different departments, do you think that this idea of taking responsibility for the production of the teaching space and the production of the teaching event is something which you import from the ensemble into OSL, from the ensemble approach into the OSL classroom, I suppose?
I think talking about production is really interesting because I say what I use across all spaces, whether I'm working with, say, philosophy students like we did the other week, or with the ensemble, is the idea which is more to do with performance, which is deadline. This has to be done. So ironically, I'm introducing into an open process, a negotiation process, a deadline, a discipline, a structure, a focus, which then they can mediate however they want to mediate, or negotiate was the word you used. That is the fundamental. Your body has to be here in this moment, in this time, and do this thing. Now, that's quite rare because actually a lot of university higher education systems of learning are based on deferral. When, you know, if you read this, when you write this, the exam, I suppose, is the closest they ever get, the written exam is the closest they ever get to the moment of live performance. But even then, it's deferred because it's written and transmitted and it is read much later the moment of its writing. So there's something to do with the liveness of the performance deadline or the moment, which is obviously hugely contested in performance theory, but is something that's absolutely transferable across everything that I do on this project. But the problem with production is, yes, with the ensemble I'm spending hours and hours and hours and hours over weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks creating a production. Mm-hmm. So they're learning about the kind of crafts of cultural production. But that's only possible because of a process. And it's actually the interplay between the production and the process, and how the process feeds into the production, and the production provides a focal point for the process, that is the heart of all good drama learning. Mm-hmm. And certainly that is another way of connecting the ensemble projects with the the pedagogic interventions or sporadic events.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Excellent. So you've been involved with a series of workshops in across all the faculties of the university. Are there any lessons to be learned in the last 2 years of doing this? Are any lessons that you have learned, and any lessons you think that we can learn going forward?
I think that we have started to evolve and need to continue evolving a language to describe what we're doing. I mean, we spent quite a lot of this conversation talking about terminology, and I think that's good. I think there's always a danger that no matter how much successful work we've got behind us, there's always a danger that colleagues or students will misunderstand the work's muscularity with words or phrases or descriptions of events mm-hmm. that seem arty-farty, too ephemeral, mm-hmm. or even subversive to this kind of theories of knowledge that mm-hmm. that are assumed by creating a university. So, you know, you do get proposals. You know, there's nothing wrong. For example, what would be a terribly unfair example? There's nothing wrong with saying we're going to do thermodynamics through ballet. There's nothing wrong with that.
Sure.
There are many great thermodynamic people, experts, and many great ballet companies who could do something really very interesting that would be interdisciplinary and of value to that. There is a danger in saying that's the kind of work that we do mm-hmm. To colleagues who have a research interest in thermodynamics and students who are terrified by the idea of becoming a ballet dancer mm-hmm. when they say, oh, well, that's sort of over there. Mm-hmm. We need to be very clear, and the best examples that we've got are us being clear about the pedagogic value of the work and the academic as well as personal reasoning behind making people stand up and use their body in a room. So, you know, I'm actually still thinking about thermodynamics and ballet because I think it could be a really interesting project. But the example was, you know, you see something written down, you think, oh, well, that's just out there and weird, and it's based on sort of assumptions about what artists can do to transform people's lives. Well, no, actually, part of what we're saying is this has value to anyone, that everybody has to think about their body in space, and that actually what we need to do is continue to provide academic discourse, even though there's a problem in saying, well, we need academic discourse mm-hmm. because we need academic discourse to justify why we're not going to use academic discourse. But yes, mm-hmm. we need academic discourse to justify why we're standing up mm-hmm. and what the problems are from what is happening with epistemology and ontology in these kind of experiences. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way forward, because then we say, well,
yeah,
show me something that disproves this. Mm-hmm. You know, then it becomes that kind of argument. You know, sure. this is as far yeah. we've got. We're not saying it's the only way, but we need, you know, a strong rationale. We're starting to do that. We're starting to publish in that way. Mm-hmm. And it's totally absurd.
Yeah.
Because we're being forced to document and we're being forced into the written word mm-hmm. to defend the body.
Yeah.
But it was ever thus. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So. I mean, practically speaking, what do you think we can do to embed the OSL project as it draws to a close in future years in this university?
Well, I think, you know, what we're starting to do is we're starting to form long-lasting, meaningful relationships with departments, and I think we've got to sustain those. Mm-hmm. So we've got quite targeted strategic relationships with philosophy, psychiatry, chemistry, law, many of whom have an OSL project. Business would be another example. But it's about not just saying, okay, let's keep repeating that. How do we push that forward? So how do you build, for example, Phillit, been working with them for a few years. So this year, the challenge was, let's try pure philosophy and the maths and philosophy and the PPEs. How far will this go? Mm-hmm. But also, I'm, you know, okay, I got an opportunity to use my subject specialism and look at not I, but it forced me to think, well, that wouldn't be enough, which is why I introduced something which actually I didn't need to do, but I introduced the Plato and the Collingwood, mm-hmm. because I went to the lecture and I realised that was the focus. So I had to find a way of connecting it to that. Yeah. And, you know, if we then did something that was just for the space between mathematics and philosophy, which is presumably logic, mm-hmm. what would I need to do? What would I need to change again? So we have to be, we have to keep challenging ourselves, but they have to be based on the friendships and collaborative partners we already have. Mm.
You're also emphasising the academic centrality of it. I mean, the academic seriousness of it.
Yeah. I actually feel it should be part of the curriculum.
Yeah. And I was wondering, is that a potential problem that OSL is being seen or could be seen to be a skills-based program, kind of program?
Yeah.
Presentation skills.
Yeah. I think there's a danger there, because I think if the focus is only on interpersonal skills, presentation skills, communication skills, the so-called soft skills, which are not soft, then it's seen as an add-on, it's seen as something the university administrative registry could deliver, it's seen as a vocational preparation that is, you know, commodified as part of the student's graduateness, and it is separated from the academic experience. That's never been the philosophy, and those projects that are doing that simply aren't as interesting, mm-hmm. As the projects who try to think about that alongside genuine research questions. Mm-hmm. And that's when we start to get into the sort of the real pedagogy of it, mm-hmm. of what is a university for? What are students meant to be doing? What kind of interactions are students meant to be having with producers of knowledge, if that's what we assume academics are? Mm-hmm. So it's a really good question in that sense. But one of the things you have to do in order to ensure funding for very good and interesting work is to point out what value it has to the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And one indisputable value of this approach is that people get to practice standing up, speaking for themselves, connecting with an audience, and all of those things that aren't soft skills. They're the kind of hard skills that employers recruit on. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't want to see that go,
sure.
because it has to be connected to something else. Yeah. If that's all we're doing for academic departments, then you're right, skills provision, and it's not really pedagogy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, finally, is there anything you would do differently? Over the last two years of this project, anything you think, well, that just didn't work, we would have established this in a different footing?
That's a very good question. I think that we probably could have been clearer from the start about the value of what we were doing, and potentially more militant with the institution about what we needed in order to do it well. We are always overstretched. I'm personally teaching in every faculty, as you know, and sometimes in the same day. And actually, the better model, the reflective model, is, okay, how do we train a team of people who can do this? Mm-hmm. How do we get the institution to say, no, this is a requirement of the curriculum? But of course, we weren't at that stage at the start of it. So it's only now that we realise where we need to go, and the university is asking us to do that as part of the IATL brief. Mm-hmm. But there is a slight confusion amongst service users between the difference between Capital, OSL and IATL. You know, and the overlap of that and the differences between those three things
one could also add things like the student ensemble, the fail better residency. There are other things that complicate it, that just lead to lack of clarity, but also lead to the same small group of people delivering too much work. But we've always been aware of that as a problem. It's just that 2 years later, we still don't have a way to answer that problem.
Yeah.
And the university hasn't completely succeeded in supporting us with that.
Yeah.
Any questions, Adam?
Adam.
I was going to ask you something which I think you very briefly covered right at the end there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was going to ask you, could you briefly comment on the some of the internal dynamics of the student groups that you've worked with over the last year? How do they compare to the internal dynamics of actors that you might have worked with in the past? Were there any problems? And if so, do you have any suggestions as to how to overcome them?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think this comes down to what kind of learning styles student groups have and whether it can be seen or said that certain disciplines attract certain kinds of learning styles. For example, you know, one of the good things about the workshop approach is there's something for a visual learner, a kinesthetic learner, and an auditory learner happening all at the same time. Isn't always true of the lecture, for example. But there's also that stuff around learners who are activists or reflectors or pragmatists or theorists, and that is very detectable in certain groups. For example, when working with the MBA, more so the MBA than the Kiln students, but the MBA students felt a bit like working with performers, presumably because performers and business people are activists primarily. They are doers, they're used to doing with their body, they're used to being highly creative on their feet, thinking on their feet, and as such they're very challenging learners. But if you handle them in the right way, they're really exciting learners because they get why they're there and doing it, and they want to go, 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 go. Now, the chemists and the, let's say, the law and management students are more apprehensive about why they're in their room. Sometimes that's to do with how the department has set up the experience for them. Sometimes it's just because they're apprehensive about doing something that feels like drama when they've enrolled to do a science degree. So that's where the environment has to be open enough to feel safe. Or I should say open, but also with structures that close it in order to make them feel safe. Our research shows that a small proportion will not enjoy the experience or will not see the absolute value of it immediately. That's quite a small proportion, but it's something that's true of any human group, regardless what degree they're studying, who just don't really learn in that way, or if they don't think they learn in that way, or they don't quite get it, or they just simply don't see the value in getting up and moving around, and they don't see the connection between that and knowledge, because knowledge for them is transmitted through texts. So I sometimes am immediately aware that I've got a plan in my hand that's not going to work with the group that's just walked in, regardless of previous experiences of that subject or what the academics told me it's going to be like. So what you actually need to have as a workshop facilitator is multiple plans in your head so you can do different things if the group suddenly seems freaked out or seems like it's not quite clear why they're there or why they're doing it. So you just have to become really reflexive. And often if you introduce small group work or pair work or opportunities for regular reflective feedback, you get where the students are with it. You understand what they're feeling about it, and then you modify your approach. Sometimes you might expect there to be a really heavy performance focus, and you might actually soft pedal that and allow performances to take place between pairs or between groups, because you realise a group just simply isn't ready or prepared to be put on the spot in front of the whole class, as it were. I couldn't generalise subject to subject, but I sketched out a few things that I found. I mean, I should say, to summarise that, I've found the chemistry students no less willing than the English students.
interesting.
Okay. Yeah. No, thank you very much, Johnny.
Thanks very much.
That's fine, thank you.